You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Тысяч заживо сожженных строятся, строятся в шеренги к ряду ряд интернациональные колонны. С нами говорят, с нами говорят. Со всех сторон это раздается в Бухенвальде. Колокольный звон, колокольный звон, звон плывет, плывет над всей землей и гудит взволнованный мир. Люди мира, будьте зорче втрое.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was the Soviet singer Muslim Magomedov with The Alarm Bells of Buchenwald, song in commemoration of the Holocaust, and solidarity with its victims, and a song that says never again. Today marks 75 years since soldiers of the Soviet Red Army liberated over 7,000 prisoners from the Nazi death camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau. After 1,689 days and more than 1 million dead, the murder, suffering, and pain finally came to an end. Today, thousands of events took place all around the world to mark Holocaust Memorial Day, and to say never again. And I want to briefly focus on the implications of what never again means in the face of something so monstrous and evil as the Holocaust. As an editorial by the British socialist newspaper Morning Star on January 27th, 2020 put it, quote, "The murder of 6 million Jews, millions of Soviet prisoners of war, hundreds of thousands of Roma, and many gay and disabled people by the Nazi regime and its collaborators is far from history's only example of genocide, but the calculated and systematic approach to a project aimed at exterminating entire races was unique. It justifies global commemoration of this as the most horrendous crime committed by any government in history." End quote. Death was truly an industry in the Holocaust. Camps like Auschwitz-Birkenau have accurately been termed murder factories, and many corporations, including many that still exist today, such as IG Farben and ThyssenKrupp, made massive profits on the back on the backs of a workforce that was literally being worked to death. Slave labor. Nazi officials and SS commanders amassed personal fortunes by stealing from camp inmates and contracting out slave labor to the big industrial firms. Never before or since has there been such a grotesquely twisted marriage between genocidal violence and industrial capitalism on a massive scale. And of course, what followed World War II and the Holocaust was the Cold War. And the capitalist powers of North America and Western Europe certainly looked after their own. I mean, communism was the main enemy now. And the fiercely anti-communist Nazis were seen as very useful by the powers that be in America and in Western Europe. And so apart from the top Nazi leaders tried at Nuremberg, the majority of the surviving perpetrators of the Holocaust in West Germany went totally unpunished. Under the protection of the U.S. occupation authorities, the West German police, courts, military, security agencies, and bureaucracy remained largely staffed by those who had served the former Nazi regime or by their ideological sympathizers. In total contrast to socialist East Germany, where Nazis were thoroughly purged from virtually every profession. As Michael Parenti points out in his book Black Shirts and Reds, quote, "The perpetrators of the Holocaust murdered 6 million Jews, 500,000 Roma, thousands of homosexuals, several million Ukrainians, Russians, Poles, and others, and got away with it. In good part because the very people who were supposed to investigate these crimes were themselves complicit." End quote. Hundreds of Nazi war criminals were welcomed into the United States and Canada, many of whom did very well for themselves, working for U.S. intelligence agencies during the Cold War, or for an American industrial complex that was hungry for Nazi technology and know-how. I mean, the story about how Nazi rocket scientists aided America in the space race is very notorious and well-known. The German capitalists who profited from the Holocaust were likewise never punished. Hermann Abs, the head of Deutsche Bank under the Nazis and effectively Hitler's paymaster, was even celebrated by the New York Times, who wrote a glowing obituary for him after he died, for playing, quote, "a dominant role in West Germany's reconstruction after World War II. Of course, as Robert Carl Miller pointed out in an article in the Portland Free Press in October 1994, the New York Times failed to mention that Abs was a Nazi, that his bank had played a key role in the plundering of occupied Europe. And as a board member of IG Farben, he was majorly involved in the use of slave labor at Auschwitz. And he's just one of many examples. U.S. corporations such as DuPont, Ford, General Motors, ITT, and IBM were heavily involved in the Nazi economy and in the use of slave labor, but were likewise never held to account. I mean, fighting Holocaust denial means maintaining an accurate historical memory. And ever since 1945, there have been massive efforts to rewrite history, to erase the facts that I've just presented, which implicate capitalism and its role in facilitating the Holocaust. But equally concerning is the concerted effort to rewrite the history of the Second World War, to portray our wartime ally, the Soviet Union, as being jointly complicit with Nazi Germany in starting the conflict, something which is both dishonest and dangerous. I mean, Nazi Germany would not have been defeated if not for the Soviet Union. 80% of all German military casualties during the war were on the Eastern Front. The 58 Wehrmacht divisions based in Western Europe at the time of the D-Day landings were dwarfed by the 228 divisions deployed at the same time against the Soviets, at the time when the Soviets were launching Operation Bagration and were advancing into Poland. You know, more than 228 German divisions were opposing them, compared to 58 opposing the D-Day landings. You know, just an order of magnitude difference. The peoples of the Soviet Union also paid the highest price for victory in the Second World War, with 27 million lives lost, more than one in seven of the country's entire population. That's a huge number. And to dismiss this colossal sacrifice on the part of millions of Red Army soldiers, or to portray them as oppressors no better than the Nazis they fought, as is now commonplace in Ukraine, Poland, and a number of other Eastern European countries, is a shameful insult to the memory of those who liberated Auschwitz-Birkenau, as well as a shameful distortion of history. The 21st century propaganda effort in North America and in the European Union to present communism and fascism as twin totalitarian ideologies and moral equivalents is likewise an insult to the communist partisans and resistance fighters, the bravest of the brave, in the words of the late British labor leader Michael Foot, who formed the backbone of the underground resistance to Nazi occupation and fascist regimes in the occupied parts of the Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, Greece, Italy, Czechoslovakia, and France, among other countries. There's been a wholesale effort to write those people out of history, to write those communist partisans and resistance fighters out of history, and act like the whole thing never happened. And that their brave example never existed. This rewriting of history facilitates the rehabilitation of fascism. After all, they're basically writing out of history the bravest resistance fighters, the bravest people who fought against fascism. You know, this rewriting of history facilitates the rehabilitation of fascism and legitimates modern far-right movements that are growing in power and influence across Europe and beyond, posing a direct threat to marginalized peoples, ethnic minorities, working-class people, women, migrants, and LGBTQ people. I mean, Stepan Bandera, who has been elevated to the status of a national hero in Ukraine since the Maidan coup of 2013 swept the far-right U.S.-backed government to power in that country, he was a blatant and high-profile Nazi collaborator. And all these streets and statues and all kinds of stuff are being named for him. National holidays are being named for him in Ukraine. I mean, his organization of Ukrainian nationalists participated in the Holocaust and massacred hundreds of thousands of Jews and ethnic Poles in Western Ukraine, working hand in glove with the Nazi occupation authorities. And this is hardly an isolated case. I mean, Poland has passed laws against referring to the role of Polish collaborators in the Holocaust, of which there were many. Lithuania is now debating a similar ban. Monuments to the Red Army liberators of Europe are being torn down in many countries and defaced, while fascist regimes, far-right regimes from Hungary to Italy, are being rehabilitated. And of course, anti-Semitism is growing throughout Europe once more, along with the growth of these far-right movements and political forces. As I've pointed out on previous shows, the government of apartheid Israel has effectively shifted the framing of anti-Semitism from attacks and discrimination against Jewish people to any criticism of the state of Israel and its genocidal colonizing policies towards the Palestinian people. I talked last month in the aftermath of the British election about how Jeremy Corbyn was relentlessly attacked in the media as an anti-Semite because he's a supporter of Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, the real far-right anti-Semites who firebombed synagogues and smashed Jewish graves, and rehabilitate and glorify all these Nazi leaders, and these guys are emerging throughout Europe, these far-right movements, they get a free pass. The media doesn't criticize them. Doesn't go after them. It goes after anyone who supports the Palestinians. And this is to say nothing of the neo-Nazi militias in Ukraine who worship monsters like Stepan Bandera and who are now getting their guns from Israel. Which once again doesn't care. Doesn't care about the far right. What it cares about is stopping the Palestinians and crushing them. So they've worked to rewrite the very meaning of what anti-Semitism is. As opposed to like it being any attack on, attack and discrimination and against Jewish people. Now it's just considered like anyone who criticizes the state of Israel and supports the Palestinian resistance. I mean, this is what the Israeli human rights activist Shir Hever had to say about this particularly disgusting form of political and historical revisionism on the Real News Network on January 24th. Have a listen. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's the Real News Network, and I'm Greg Volpert in Arlington, Virginia. A ceremony to commemorate the 75th anniversary since the liberation of the Auschwitz death camp took place in Jerusalem on Thursday. The event, which the right-wing government of Benjamin Netanyahu organized, was highly politicized and tried to exploit the memory of the Holocaust in an effort to promote Israel's occupation, apartheid, and colonial rule over Palestinians. 47 world leaders were invited to the ceremony in Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial and Museum in Jerusalem. The guest list included Russian President Vladimir Putin and U.S. Vice President Mike Pence, as well as most leaders of Europe. No representatives from Africa, East Asia, or Latin America were invited, except for the President of Argentina. Only 60 invitations were given to Holocaust survivors and their families. Zvi Eichner, who is 94 years old, is one of the very last living survivors of Auschwitz, and he was refused entry to the ceremony because there was no room for him. The event included a cocktail party and an after party with a DJ and with plenty of drinking and dancing. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu asked guests at the ceremony to sign a statement against the International Criminal Court, which claims that the ICC has no jurisdiction over Palestinian land. Leading up to the ceremony, Netanyahu gave an interview to the Christian television network TBN, where he tried to rally Christians against the ICC.
I think that everybody should rise up against this. The U.S. government, under President Trump, has spoken forcefully against the ICC for this travesty, and I urge all your viewers to do the same and to ask for concrete actions, sanctions against the international court, its officials, its prosecutors, everyone. So they're basically on a full frontal attack on the democracies, both on the democracies' right to defend themselves and on Israel's right, the Jewish people's right, to live in their ancestral homeland, the land of Israel. A third of the Jewish people went up in flames. There was nothing we could do. Now, after the Holocaust, the state of Israel was established. And the attempts to destroy the Jewish people have not disappeared. Iran openly declares every day that it wants to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And by the way, Israel has today a population of more than 6 million Jews.
Joining me now to analyze the instrumentalization of the Holocaust for Israeli impunity is Shir Hever. Shir is a Real News correspondent in Heidelberg, Germany, and author of the book, The Privatization of Israeli Security. Thanks for joining us again, Shir.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
So why do you think that no leaders from the Global South were invited to this event, and also why there were so few Holocaust survivors?
Well, I think it's clear that for the Israeli government, this was not about commemorating the Holocaust at all. It was about power. And the Israeli government is using the Holocaust as if it was some kind of property that they can leverage in order to influence world leaders. The 47 world leaders that came to Jerusalem did that because they wanted to make a show of how important the memory of the Holocaust is for them, and to ensure that never again atrocities such as the ones that happened during the Second World War, during the Holocaust, will occur once more. But for the Israeli government, this was not the purpose of the ceremony at all. They wanted a coalition of leaders from the global north, powerful, influential politicians from the United States, from Russia, from other European countries, and in order to get them to sign this declaration against the International Criminal Court. In a very ironic way, and very sadly ironic, the same ceremony which was intended to commemorate war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by the Nazis is now used by the Israeli government to avoid accountability for war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court itself.
Now, turning to the ICC, it recently rejected the filing that ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda submitted for the launch of an investigation of Israeli crimes in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip because the application was too long. That is, Bensouda had gathered 110 pages of evidence, and the ICC wanted her to summarize it in 30 pages. Now, in light of this massive amount of evidence, what good do you think it will do to Netanyahu if some world leaders say that the ICC has no jurisdiction?
The legal case against Israel is very clear. The evidence is overwhelming. We have testimonies of the soldiers themselves, where they testify of the use of illegal weaponry, targeting of defenseless civilians. These count as war crimes. And also a lot of Israeli lawyers admit that because the Israeli legal system itself fails to hold Israeli soldiers and officers accountable for war crimes, then that makes these officers and also the government, the politicians who order them, accountable under international law. And there's nothing that Netanyahu can do in a ceremony in Jerusalem and getting various world leaders to say how they oppose the ICC that will change these legal facts. But Netanyahu knows very well that legal battles are not just fought in the courtroom. They're actually very political and politicized. And he wants to create a wide alliance of world leaders who also have something to hide from the International Criminal Court, who also have their own dirty laundry that they don't want international accountability for. So he wants to offer them this kind of deal. If they support Israel unconditionally, if they support Israel against the International Criminal Court, then they will come to Yad Vashem, and in the words of Itai Mak, an Israeli human rights lawyer, Yad Vashem has become a laundromat to clean, to wash away their crimes in the eyes of the international community in exchange for their support for Israel. Mostly, I think Netanyahu is doing that for his own domestic purposes, because the election in Israel for the third time and in 1 year is going to happen in March. And Netanyahu knows that any advancement in the International Criminal Court case against Israel just before the election is going to look very bad for him. So I think partially the reason that the ICC decided to postpone accepting the petition to open the investigation by Fatou Bensouda and ask her first to summarize her case in fewer pages, this is just going to delay things by a couple of months. And a couple of months is actually all that Netanyahu needs in order to go to the election as somebody who is successfully protecting Israeli officers and politicians from accountability under international law.
Now, the Israeli government wasn't always so hostile towards international law, and the change in direction towards the ICC actually came before the chief prosecutor Fatou Bensouda decided to launch an investigation. Tell us a little bit about the history of the ICC and the Israeli government's relationship to it.
Right. The ICC itself was actually only established in 2002. It's relatively young, but the process to establish it and to create universal jurisdiction for international crimes is a process that actually started with the Nuremberg trials after the Holocaust. And many lawyers who were involved in that were specifically thinking about the Holocaust as the kind of crime that must be fought against and avoided by creating accountability. A lot of Jewish lawyers as well, and also when the State of Israel was founded shortly afterwards, Israeli officials and members of the Israeli official judicial system that participated in the process of creating an international court. Therefore, in 2002, when the Rome Convention was drafted to establish the International Criminal Court, there was a lot of surprise that the state of Israel chose not to sign it and not to accept jurisdiction of the ICC over its own territory, because people expected that the state of Israel would be part of that process. But I think over the years, the state of Israel has changed its attitude towards international law and towards the international jurisdiction. I think a lot of Israeli politicians realize that they're not on the side of victims of prosecution and racism as the Jewish people were before the establishment of the state of Israel, but rather they are on the side of the occupiers and colonialists, and actually they are the ones who are going to be held accountable. And I think that was a shift in the perception within the Israeli society and within the Israeli political system that made it very hostile to international jurisdiction. Today, demonstrators in Israel that want to protest against the government policies in the occupied territory shout, "We will see you in The Hague," meaning we will take you Israeli leaders to be accountable in the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So The Hague has become a kind of boogie person to the Israeli leadership. And therefore, the Israeli government is, Netanyahu even called Fatou Ben Suda and the ICC anti-Semites because they dare hold the state of Israel to the same standard that the rest of the world has to stand up to.
Now, I just want to turn finally to, again, the instrumentalization of the Holocaust Memorial. Now, this fits in the larger context in which Netanyahu in 2009 compared the Hamas party to the Nazi party. And in 2015, he claimed that it was a Palestinian and not Hitler who came up with the idea to exterminate Jews during the Holocaust. Now, Netanyahu is blatantly using the Holocaust to avoid accountability, as we've already mentioned. And you also mentioned Etai Mack, who called it a laundromat, this effort to launder the image of far-right racists when they pledged support for the Israeli government. Now, talk to us about the reaction that is of Jews, both in Israel and around the world, to this instrumentalization of the Holocaust Memorial. And what do you think it would be an appropriate reaction to this?
Yeah, I think the process that you're describing, starting in 2009 with equating the Hamas party and the Nazi party, because according to Netanyahu, both of them wanted to exterminate the Jews, which is completely false. The Hamas party never called to exterminate the Jews, and also never had the means to really challenge the Israeli military in battle. Then we have, you mentioned 2015, where Netanyahu made a much more distressing quote, made this quote about blaming the idea of genocide against Jews not on Adolf Hitler but rather on Haj Amin al-Husseini, a Palestinian who did want to kill Jews but certainly cannot be considered the initiator of that idea. So when he made those statements, there was a lot of backlash and a lot of anger. But I think now with the ceremony, which is also an extremely tasteless ceremony with the party and the dancing and drinks and DJ, then the responses are even harsher now. And there are articles published mainly by Jews who don't live in Israel, by American Jews, by Canadian Jews, by European Jews, who are horrified, but because they see how their claim on demanding equality and human rights and protection from racism in order to prevent the recurrence of the crimes of the Holocaust is shattered by the state of Israel, who is abusing that memory to actually promote crimes. And I think the consequence is horrifying. This is part of a rising populist right wing all over the world, of people like Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Matteo Salvini in Italy, Viktor Orban in Hungary, all very good friends of Netanyahu. And they all say that it's okay to be racist, it's okay to be far right, and even to be Islamophobic and even to hate Jews as long as you support the state of Israel. And Netanyahu is telling all these people, yes, it's okay, as long as you support me, as long as you buy Israeli weapons, as long as you come to Yad Vashem and pretend to care about the history, we are going to clean you of your guilt regarding racism. And I think the complicity of the Yad Vashem Museum in this is also horrifying. A lot of Israeli journalists even are writing, maybe it's time to close that museum because it's no longer serving its purpose. Instead of preserving the memory of the Holocaust in order to teach a lesson for the future, it is now just manipulating that memory in order to support the right-wing government.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave it there for now. I'm speaking to Shir Hever, Real News Network correspondent in Heidelberg, Germany. Thanks again, Shir, for having joined us today.
Thank you, Greg.
And thank you for joining the Real News Network.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Midnight Oil with White Skin, Black Heart, anti-fascist song. And you're listening, of course, to Back in the USSR's commemoration Holocaust Memorial Day episode of the show. And of course, we heard Shir Hever's talk, his interview on the Real News Network, Israeli human rights activist, talking about how the apartheid government of Israel exploits the Holocaust to justify war crimes against Palestinians and is willing to work with extremely far-right, Islamophobic, even anti-Semitic far-right groups in Europe and far-right governments in Europe and around the world to achieve that goal. And as I said before the break, I mean, it's no surprise that increasingly what the Israeli government defines as anti-Semitism, and the definition of anti-Semitism it's trying to propagate around the world, basically is anyone who supports the Palestinians. You know, supporting the Palestinians makes you an anti-Semite, according to Israel. You know, but being part of a far-right group, being part of a fascist or neo-Nazi group, they could care less. They don't care if your government is far-right, or like is facilitating fascism or facilitating Nazism or like anti-Semitic forces or any of that kind of stuff. They don't care. The only thing they care about is if you, you know, as long as you just support the state of Israel and oppose Palestine. And they will support you. They may even give you guns, just like the Israeli government gives guns to neo-Nazi militias in Ukraine, like the Azov Battalion and the right sector. So, and of course, I've talked about the different forms of historical revisionism, the very dangerous forms of historical revisionism that have happened surrounding the World War II and the Holocaust. Whether that's like denying the participation of major corporations in the Holocaust, they're profiting from the Holocaust, they're profiting off of slave labor. Or like trying to rewrite the history of World War II to equate fascism and communism. And of course, it was the USSR that in fact liberated Auschwitz and brought an end to the Holocaust. And they were not moral equivalents at all. I mean, there's another less well-known anniversary today that I'd like to draw your attention to, comrades and friends. January 27th, 1944, on that day, the siege of Leningrad was lifted. It lasted 900 days. You know, 900 days, the city of Leningrad in the Soviet Union was besieged by the army of Nazi Germany. And yet the starving, besieged Red Army garrison and workers' militias managed not only to lift the siege in 1944, but even to encircle and eliminate the Nazi troops that had besieged the city starting from 1941. From 1941 to 1944. So for 3 years. And then the Red Army was able to encircle and destroy those Nazi troops that had besieged the city and killed so many people. I mean, according to different estimations, between 600,000 and 1.5 million civilians died of famine and bombing during the siege of Leningrad. I mean, the mission to capture, I mean, the status of Leningrad is the font, the source of the Russian Revolution, you know, where the revolution of 1917 took place, made its capture a primary mission for the Nazis. You know, the Nazis wanted to take it, they wanted to destroy this city, which had been, had given rise to socialist revolution in 1917 and where the Soviet Union really was born. They wanted to destroy it. I mean, the Nazi and fascist volunteer divisions from all over Europe were deployed to the siege of Leningrad. And yet the city did not surrender, despite being under siege for 3 years and facing like some of the most horrendous conditions imaginable. I mean, there were Red Army soldiers who were so exhausted and hungry that they actually had to almost crawl to the front line to fight against the Nazis. I mean, the economic destruction and human losses in Leningrad exceeded those of the Battle of Stalingrad, the Battle of Moscow, or the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And yet, despite the massive hardship and destruction, the people of Leningrad, the people of Leningrad didn't surrender and continued heroically resisting the Nazis. You know, just as the Soviet Union as a whole, like, heroically resisted the Nazi invasion. The Nazi invasion, which was called Operation Barbarossa, which was unleashed on the Soviet Union in 1941. There were 4 million Nazi soldiers in that invasion, invading the USSR on an 1,800-mile front. It was the biggest invasion in the history of warfare. And the Nazi focus on Leningrad, as I've said, was motivated by its political status as the former capital of Russia and the symbolic capital of the Russian Revolution. But of course, it also had military importance and industrial importance, including numerous arms factories that the Nazis wanted to take over. But the siege of Leningrad after 900 days was lifted on January 27th, 1944, in the wake of Operation Iskra, which was what the operation by the Red Army to lift the siege of Leningrad was called. And after fierce battles, the Red Army units overcame the powerful German fortifications and expelled the German forces from the southern outskirts of the city, breaking the siege. The German invasion of the Soviet Union ultimately resulted in 95% of all German army casualties from 1941 to 1944, and 65% of all Allied military casualties accumulated throughout the war. As I said before, and this is another thing that often gets written out of history as history is rewritten, the history of the Second World War is rewritten, to deny the sacrifice that the Soviet Union made in the defeat of the Nazis. The largest battles of that war were on the Eastern Front. You know, 27 million Soviet citizens died in that war. You know, far more than as the ones who died in Britain or the U.S. or Canada. And certainly that victory would not have been achieved had not been for the sacrifice of the Soviet Union and the Red Army and their heroic efforts at defeating fascism. You know, culminating in the Battle for Berlin and the taking of the Reichstag in 1945. Which led to the final defeat of Nazi Germany. You know, it was in Leningrad and Stalingrad that the incalculable sacrifice and heroic resistance of the Soviet people broke the back of the Nazis and ensured the defeat of fascism in World War II. And that needs to be remembered. You know, there's a lot of propaganda. You're increasing a huge amount of propaganda going on in the world, you know, which, you know, seen the kind of attempts to demonize Russia in recent years. And that extends the rewriting of World War II, the history of World War II, to try to write out the Russian contribution. You know, the massive Russian contribution to defeating Nazism and their liberation of places like Auschwitz, you know, the ending of the Holocaust. You know, instead we get all this propaganda trying to equate Nazism and communism somehow being the same thing, which of course it's not. And never was. Fascism and communism are implacable enemies. And always have been. You know, as I pointed out before, communists were at the forefront of the resistance movements against fascism throughout Europe. Were the backbone of those resistance movements. And that's the history that needs to be remembered. You know, communists were at the forefront of resistance inside the camps themselves, inside the concentration camps. There was, the resistance movement was there too. You know, sabotage took place. You know, inside the camps themselves. You know, there was great courage displayed. And this needs to be remembered. Just as the role that capitalism played in the Holocaust needs to be remembered. And the fact that these corporations which profited in the Holocaust still need to be held to account for what they did. So it's very, very important to remember and to understand what to remember means. And remembrance means taking action now, fighting against fascism now, fighting against the far right now. Because these forces are still here. And they need to be opposed now. More than ever. And that's our responsibility. Brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, that's our responsibility. We have to do that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Neo-Nazis take a seat on a London council. The extreme right-wing racist British National Party has scored its first political success in Britain. In a council by-election last night, it took the Millwall ward of Tower Hamlets in London's East End. The area has been the scene of a string of vicious race attacks. A week ago, 17-year-old Asian Qadis Ali was beaten senseless by a white gang and left for dead. He's still in a hospital with a coma.
What can anybody do about it?
Fight them, basically.
But how do you mean fight them?
We'd say that the ideas that they put forward outside football grounds on working class estates have to be combated politically, but also that they've got a physical agenda and that has to be met physically as well. People have to defend themselves against the fascists. They can't just turn the other cheek.
Back, valley burnt down to the last attack. Till I lost no time. smashed it in its infancy with the utmost force. But once we agree with them, waving placards and chanting at fascists through megaphones accomplishes absolutely nothing. The only way to stop Nazi scum like the BNP is by physically confronting them and literally kicking them off our streets.
Boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin. Attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs. I got passion, burn mics up to ashes. I make fascists clap their pants, stanzas, cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed. Punch, crash the fun by metric tons. And plus my math, distribute cash among the classes. Take from the thieving greedy bastard, give back like church hats to get past. Collapse structure, fuck facades. I destruct the support beams and bars. Wrecking ball, large, resistance, subversive diction. Flip the shit just like a brick flow. Dethrone kings, bring the trees on. My tone rock like Gibraltar pop. Hip hop hotter than a rocket shot. I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big dog. Teach you to flee from the flock, walk off. Switch shit, hit my target. Drop like bombs in the form of carpets. I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a wrap. Original rap at taking it back. Boom bap, boom bap.
Boom bap, original rap.
I'm talking true path, master the craft. The pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
Boom bap, original rap.
If you had the opportunity to save a life, would you take it? Sounds like a no-brainer, right? And yet only 31% of people in Ontario have registered their consent to donate their organs and tissue in the event of their death. That means, on average, one person will die every 3 days because an organ is not available to save them. By registering, you have the opportunity to save as many as 8 people's lives through organ donation and to improve the quality of life for up to 75 people through tissue donation. If you want to become a donor, go to beadonor.ca. Take 2 minutes to register your consent to save a life. And don't forget to share your wishes with your family afterwards. In the words of Mike Willis, a very grateful heart recipient,
"If someone hadn't registered their consent to donate, I would not be alive today." Tune into Viejoteca every Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. on CFRU.